This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and it is Friday, so that means it's time for the Week in Review, and we'll start with charter schools. Looming this November, the possibility of a high-profile ballot fight over raising the statewide cap on charter schools. Well, this week, the state Senate tried to head off that battle with its compromise bill that would increase the number of charter schools in the state while also creating tighter restrictions on how they operate. Here's one of the bill's sponsors, State Senator Sonia Chang-Diaz.
I really challenge anybody to read this bill and find a place where they have a concern about equity or a duality that is not addressed in it.
And you know, charter school advocates and district school advocates almost never agree on anything. But for the first time, they agree on this. No one likes this compromise bill. Here's Massachusetts Charter Public School Association Executive Director Mark Keenan.
This is not a bill that's going to provide relief to the 34,000 families that are stuck on charter school waiting lists across the state.
And the group Save Our Public Schools says the bill, quote, would perpetuate the very serious problem inherent in lifting the cap yet again, the expansion of a separate and unequal system, end quote. Well, joining us now for some analysis is our Week in Review panel. Today we have Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and Harvard Law School professor. Judge Gertner, it's great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is Charlie Chipio. He's a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Ash Center at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, it's great to have you back as well.
Good to be here, Meghna.
Okay, so let me just get both of your first thoughts on this charter school compromise bill from the state Senate. As I mentioned, no one on either side of the advocacy divide here likes it. Charlie, what do you think about it?
Well, before I rip it, let me just say that...
There's the answer.
That concludes the presentation. Okay.
That the Senate was in a very difficult position. The sides are so far apart on this. But I would say that, look, I think this bill is really an effort to kill charter schools by a Senate that has long been opposed to charter schools. And I would just briefly say that, you know, it really sort of boggles the imagination that you have schools that have been shown to be do so dramatically better than their surrounding district schools by so many different researchers using so many different methodologies, yet still we look for ways to tear them down rather than to create more of them.
Okay, so Charlie, I can hear the district school advocates who are listening right now getting mad at me for not pushing back at you.
Push, but
let me just start with one thing. I mean, you think this bill is going to kill charter schools? I mean,
no.
It lifts the cap entirely on schools that would serve high-risk students.
And that's fine. And that's perfectly fine. But the reality is here that, look, the district folks use a couple of arguments that I think out of desperation they continue to use, even though they have been proven wrong. You know, one is this issue that that somehow they are creaming when the kids are chosen by lottery. You know, the second is this idea that they don't have any English language learners or special ed students, when the most recent evidence shows that, in fact, the numbers of those kids have dramatically increased in these schools. And then there's the money thing, where somehow you've got these districts that are getting 2.5 years worth or 2.25 years worth of reimbursement after a student leaves. And they actually look us in the face and say that's not enough. And they truly believe, apparently, that they deserve to continue to get funded in perpetuity for kids they no longer educate.
Okay. Nancy Gertner, your thoughts?
Where do you begin? I mean, it's essentially, I'm not sure where I stand specifically on the bill as an effort to kill charter schools. It seems to me that as the Globe reported, the bill actually has some interesting things to it, which is this notion that there'll be everyone will be in the lottery, and a parent will then have the option of a charter school or a district school, mm-hmm. and can opt out as a way of making sure that the pool of potential charter school students is broader than it might otherwise be, which is, it seems to me, is a good thing.
Well, and in fact, this is something that district school advocates don't really like. I mean, Mayor Marty Walsh wants to do the same thing in Boston,
yeah.
and he met with significant pushback on
right,
that.
Right, right. But I mean, I think the larger question is we have a finite number of dollars for education, and it's a zero-sum game. What you give to one, you don't necessarily give to the other. And the question here, the broader question, is whether or not lifting the cap on charter schools, even though they're well-performing, will essentially mean not investing as we should in public schools. And I think that we were talking before we went on about New Orleans. In New Orleans, there wasn't a zero-sum game because after Katrina, there was no effective public school system. And there is here, although it's not very good. And unless we have charter schools for all, which we never will, then there is a concern about taking resources away from public students.
And I mean, and that's a concern that district school advocates repeatedly raise. And I mean, but Charlie, let me just get back to something that Judge Gertner pointed out, and yep. That is this opt-out idea.
I think that's a good idea. Actually, that's something I should say, out of fairness, that's something in that bill that I think is a very good idea.
Okay. Now, what about the idea that maybe it's a good bill because no one really likes it? It is, by definition, a compromise
bill.
Yeah,
but the reality is that, look, that's not the way it's going to play out, because the reality is that the governor is certainly not going to go for this. The House is not going to go for this. And what it means, essentially, is that it's going to get resolved in November, which is probably the way it was always going to happen anyway, because this is going to be on the statewide ballot in November.
It's going to be on the ballot for sure.
I think it is overwhelmingly likely in the wake of this that that's the way this is going.
And what do you predict is going to happen?
I think it's very hard to say, because it's very hard to say what happens. Recent polling finds the charter school folks well ahead. But, you know, the Mass Teachers Association is the most powerful, you know, single interest in Massachusetts politics, and so I wouldn't count them out.
The most powerful single interest in Massachusetts politics as a whole? Come on.
Well, you know, I would say, look, you're working... We operate in a state where 18 of the 20 political action committees that give the most to political candidates are labor organizations. At the top of that list, in terms of giving the most, or second of those 20, is the Massachusetts Teachers Association. So I think you can certainly make a case that they are, if not top, they're certainly in the top three.
Could that be because education is a big and important issue in Massachusetts?
Right, and saying that the public unions give to political candidates doesn't mean that they're wrong in what they're doing.
Oh, I'm not saying wrong. I'm not saying that means they're wrong. I'm saying that means they have a lot of influence.
But on the other hand, we have a governor right now, Governor Charlie Baker, who has been a vocal proponent and supporter of charter schools and wants the cap lifted statewide. So there's a lot of influence there in the governor's office. And so let's hear what Charlie Baker had to say today, because he has filed his own legislation to expand the number of charters in the state. He criticized the compromise bill, saying it doesn't do anything to help the thousands of kids who are still on those wait lists for charter schools.
I don't really care what the vehicle is here. I just want kids and parents to have choices. And the vast majority of the families we're talking about here can't afford to send their kids to private school. They can't afford to move. They need the schools in their community to perform on behalf of their kids.
So Nancy Gertner, this gets back to the fundamental challenge that you were raising earlier.
Right. Needing the schools to perform is the question. And what's the vehicle for that performance, and whether it is charter schools or improving the public schools? Now, I mean, I think it's a genuine dilemma. I actually don't have an affirmative position on this. I do think it's a dilemma, because the fact of the matter is that charter schools grew up in the interstices of this debate because the public schools were not performing and people were not investing in them. But when you think about expanding the cap, then you think about what the schools that are left, the public schools that are left, will look like. Mm. And that's very, very troubling. That's very troubling.
It's troubling, except for the fact that when you look at the research and you look at what's happened, that having competition has created better results for the kids left in those schools, because those schools now have to compete rather than simply operate as monopolies who never have to change, never have to react to anything. Okay, so I think the worst thing for those kids is to continue. I mean, what we're seeing this in the way that the district school advocates are talking. You know, they actually, as I said, you know, they believe that they have some sort of moral right to every penny of money that goes, that they should not have to compete for a penny of it. The reality is that the outcomes are dramatically better at charter schools, and the way we react to it is not to say, let's invest more in charter schools. The way we react to it, or at least the way the Senate has reacted to it, is to say, let's put all kinds of restrictions on charter schools so they can be less like the great schools and more like the schools that people are flocking from.
Oh, there was also a question of accountability.
I was just going to say, because the district advocates, they wouldn't call it restrictions. They'd say that the charter schools currently lie in a realm of accountability that's outside what the district
schools. Well, I would ask you this. Look at the number of charter schools that have been closed because they haven't performed well. And charter schools make up 4% of the public school population in Massachusetts. And I would say that they make up probably 90% of the schools that have been closed for not doing well in the last 20 years. So I think they are already the most accountable schools in Massachusetts.
I didn't, Nancy Gertner, I didn't mean to jump, cut you off there.
Well, I mean, the question is whether or not closing and opening seems to me sort of a nuclear option to deal with accountability. And the question is, what are the options that are short of that? But the concern about attrition rates, the concern about disciplinary, getting rid of kids who have discipline problems, that's part of the concern that we have talked about school-to-prison pipeline mm-hmm. issues. If the public schools are going to compete for the same students as the charter schools, are we going to wind up with more kids that are kicked out of school at an earlier and earlier age? I mean, I think it really is a zero-sum game, and I think that the enterprise here is to try to seek balance. Maybe the Senate bill was a balance that nobody liked, but at least there was an effort to seek balance here.
You know, what happens when we have a charter school discussion on this show very frequently is we always get back to the same sort of set of core issues, because they are the core issues,
They're the core issues,
and I appreciate that, but I don't necessarily want to have us re-debate them all over again. But I do want to ask you guys one last question about the compromise bill, and that actually is what's going to happen next, likely in November, because we mentioned the Massachusetts Teachers Association, and they have said very clearly that they would rather have a November ballot question put to voters, and the ballot measure would allow for the creation or expansion of 12 charter schools per year with a preference for proposals in the lowest performing districts. I mean, that's the proposal as it stands right now for a November ballot question. I just want to get a sense from you both. Do you think it would be better overall to put the question to voters?
At this point, I do, because I think that clearly, you know, we had an expansion in 2010, but that was an anomaly. It was a recession. We were chasing $250 million in federal money, and to get it, we had to raise the cap. Short of that, there's not really going to be any agreement on this. And I really think that perhaps at this point, going to the voters is the best option.
The problem with going to the voters is that you can't titrate the answer. You can't negotiate. If things are, as I've described, sort of a zero-sum game and the question is what the balance is, it's an all-or-nothing thing with a referendum question, and there may be other options.
Hmm. Well, let's move on now to a different topic entirely. I'm going to go out of order here a little bit, guys, because I want to jump to the gender wage gap. We're mixing it up a bit.
I'm sorry. We're going to answer whatever question we want.
That's right. We're both running for office. We're going to answer whatever question we want.
Boston announced this week that Mayor Marty Walsh announced this week that he's doubled the number of businesses that have agreed to share payroll data as a way to try to close the gender wage gap in the city. So here's a little bit more from the mayor.
We know we're the number one city in America of income inequality, and we want to be number one in a lot of places, but we don't want to be number one in that space because our city is going to become a city that's divided.
Now, this gender wage gap initiative has companies sign on to look at their wage data with the city and identify where the gaps are in the company. And according to the city, white women make 83 cents per every dollar that men make in Boston. Of course, the gap is also bigger for women of color. So, Nancy Gertner, let me start with you. Do you think data and transparency is a way forward here to close the gap?
There's no question about it. It's called shaming, right? You do it with your kids. There's no question about it. If you begin to, it's one is shaming and the other is it enables, you know, the gender gap is a comparative measure. And one of the principal issues when you go into court to claim a violation of the Equal Pay Act is that you're trying to seek other comparators and saying I'm more or less, typically less than they are. So it provides a means of even identifying an equality problem, and it also provides a means of shaming companies that are, not up to snuff. Mm. I'm all in favor.
Yeah, I agree. And I have to say that the first thing I thought as you posed this question was exactly what Judge Gertner said. I thought to myself, yes, this is exactly what I do with my kids.
Yes, so you're that's right.
We're on the same page.
Hooray for public shaming.
Yes. Yeah. But I agree. I think this is a really good approach to take to deal with this. I like it much more than sort of this kind of heavy-handed approach that's going to slap penalties on that may have unintended consequences. I think this is the right way to go about it. And I would also say that perhaps maybe even the tipping point, but the thing that may have the most impact on this is what's on the front page of the Globe today, this thing where these champion United States women's soccer players are filing this complaint
with the EEOC.
Because I have to tell you that when I read that article and I see that these women who are perennial champions, you know, make $2 for every $9 that the one and done U.S. men's team makes. I think that is going to have a major sort of national effect on this issue.
Well, so, I mean, transparency, though, can only take us so far, I think, because I see that the city, of course, is protecting the privacy of these companies. We don't necessarily have more granular level data here. And it's also up to the companies to decide that this is an issue that matters to them and mm-hmm. that then they're going to do something about it. So, you know, once we have these sort of broad-based comparisons, the 83 cents to every dollar that men make, in a way, that's not news. I mean, we've known that there's a gap. So how do you push forward then to help close it?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a first step. I mean, you need more granular data to actually do the kind of shaming. You know, something in the public square, company CEOs with a sign around their head, their neck.
Mussolini, after he was.
that's right.
This is going down a very dark path.
It is. But I think you're right. It's obviously a first step. But as I said, discrimination is a comparison. We're past the time that someone says, well, Meghna, you're going to get X pay because you're a woman. You're only going to know you're underpaid when you begin to ask everybody around you what they're paid.
But there are cultural forces that really prevent people from doing that. And even in the cases of some companies, there are actual policies that say you can't talk about it.
Private companies, there are policies, certainly. But I think that that means that women and minorities will only know about what's going on by accident. And if this is an effort to begin to regularize that information, however half-baked at least, it's a good effort.
I think we need to see what these companies do with this information once it's out there. I know the mayor's office, they are certainly offering some sort of technical assistance to companies that want to get better. So let's see if the combination of the information and the assistance can do it. If it doesn't make a difference, then yes, then maybe we have to get more aggressive. But I think this is the place to start.
You know, a 2013 report from the city of Boston also had a bunch of suggestions for interventions, for lack of a better term, to help close the gender wage gap, following gender-blind application processes, standardizing compensation for companies where that might work, offering subsidized childcare, things like that. I mean, my sort of big policy question links back to what we heard the mayor say a little earlier, that, I mean, women are an enormous part of the modern day labor force. I mean, you can't have a growing economy in a vibrant city without this part of the workforce being as equally engaged as the male part. And I think the mayor's exactly right to say, for the health and future of the city's economy, we have to do something about this.
Right. But it's a much more complicated issue. So it's a question, last part of what you were talking about, which is to say the issues of childcare, that's almost an affirmative obligation that a company would have to do. It's more than just, I may pay you equal, but if you have all the childcare responsibilities, then it's not going to matter because you won't be able to be an equal worker in some respects. So the childcare issue is a separate issue. But if we see a gender gap that persists over time, then at least we begin to ask the question of why and how do we address it? Mm-hmm. And if that remains in the forefront of the discussion, that's terrific. And it seems to me that that alone is worth the price of this.
But I think the point of what the mayor was saying, and I think he's right, is this basic idea. At 30,000 feet, it's the same as, you know, gay rights issues or other, you know, that we do not have the luxury in the 21st century of excluding the talents of any group of people. It simply doesn't make sense. It's not in our interest. And that's the bottom line. And that's what we have to try to get to.
All right. Well, let's move on for just a moment, if we can, to another issue that cropped up this week. And that is one that also could end up on the ballot this November, but just in the city of Boston, because city councilors held a hearing this week about a proposal to add a 1% surcharge on Boston property taxes as part of the Community Preservation Act. And that's revenue that would go towards affordable housing, open space, and historic preservation. Now, city leaders have made the argument that this money is needed to achieve those three things: affordable housing, open space, and historic preservation. So just want to get your quick thoughts on, do you think it would help the city, or would it further... encumber property owners who say that taxes are already too high in Boston. Charlie, I'm going to start with you.
You know, this is one of these things where I don't think it's going to have a huge impact either way. But I think that it's one of the things that I just get stuck on with stuff like this is what this issue is yet another way in which we're trying to get around dysfunction, because we don't fund these things the way we should. And so if we don't, we come up with these ideas where, well, you know, we'll set aside money here and we'll put it in a pool and we'll match it and we'll use it. And it just seems that at the end of the day, after all this sort of dancing around this stuff, the impact is not great. Mm. And I just think that we have to stop. I would just like to see these issues addressed honestly and addressed head on. I guess that's my sort of larger reaction to
this Nancy,
issue.
Well, Nancy, before I turn to you, I just want to play a couple pieces of tape from folks who had also some thoughts on this. Here's Joe Kreisberg. He's president of the Massachusetts Association of Community Development Corporations. They, of course, support the surcharge. And he said to us that most Boston residents wouldn't have to pay much of anything. The average homeowner would pay only about $23 a year in this community tax.
We've made it so that it's very progressive, it's very fair, and it's very affordable. But the benefits are going to be great.
And Greg Vassell, who's chief executive of the Greater Boston Real Estate Board, said he's got concerns because it's already expensive for developers to build in Boston, and commercial property taxes are more than double the residential property tax rate.
If you increase that, what is that really going to do to your bottom line and for the numbers that you have to do to drive and to make the city successful? It's a little tenuous.
So, Nancy, what's your view here?
Well, it's a funny kind of situation. If it is, in fact, de minimis, so that it's not going to make that much of a difference in terms of people's the property taxes, et cetera, and the affordability of housing, then it's also going to be de minimis with respect to
right.
affordable housing, open space, recreation, and historic preservation. If it's more than that, so it's actually going to make a difference, then the question is, what impact does it have on prices in Boston and commercial development, et cetera? I take Charlie's point that we ought to be like a European city and say open spaces, in fact, contribute to everyone's development. Affordable housing is critical in an urban center, and do it directly. The problem is that we've over the past, 20 years, that you know, once you mention tax on anything.
Right. I was going to say, when's the last time voters actually approved the tax
right.
on
yeah.
themselves?
Right. And so to some degree, we're forced to do it by indirection, however, uncomfortable that may make us, but that may be the only way. I'm torn because it seems to me, on the one hand, you want to have a debate that says, really, this is something we ought to be contributing
yeah.
to, and end of, you know, full stop. But I'm not, I mean, I it seems de minimis, and it seems it will help even at the margins and not hurt.
Okay. Well, with that thought, we now just have just enough time for our hubbubs this week, and those were the stories that maybe didn't make it top of fold, but are worth a mention anyway. So, Charlie, what's your hubbub?
My hubbub this week is that we have there was an issue this week that is one of those only in Massachusetts issues that I wanted to bring up, which is that this week, State Auditor Suzanne Bump actually approved a privatization. And that means that, you know, only in Massachusetts, of course, privatization is essentially illegal. We have this thing called the Pacheco Law that makes it harder to privatize anything than in any other state. And so the reason I think this should be news is, A, because I would argue that the law is insane, but B, because the law is written such that the fact that a privatization was approved this week is news, because in 23 years since this law has been passed, there has been less than one privatization per year that has been approved. So this is actually quite amazing that mental health services in southeastern Mass will be privatized and save about $7 million.
Huh, wow.
I had a mental exercise. I wanted to, as I was watching the Republican debate the other night.
Well, that's never a good
idea. Right. I wanted for a moment to pretend that it was Dora Trump against Teresa Cruz. And I wanted to see what people's reactions would be if two women behave that way. Now, people are saying, you know, bad behavior, you know, this sounds like the schoolyard. I can't imagine the stereotypes that would flow from Donald Trump's
okay.
mouth. Where were to envision two women getting that, what, cat fight? I mean, all of these incredible.
That would
majority.
Be among the kinder things.
That's right. That's right. And we would only have to think about what Donald Trump would do. I mean, it's at a level that is so. We would say that it would be disqualifying that women are not capable of being.
They would be labeled unpresidential from the start.
Unpresidential. They weren't presidential to begin with. They surely would be unpresidential now. But think of that as a thought experiment, and then go and throw up.
I love that. God. I think that's great.
Okay, well, so my hubbub today, every once in a while, my husband dares me to try and bring up stories that I may not be able to make it through with a straight face. So Keith, if you're listening, I'm going to try it today, because this hubbub brings together three loves of mine. One is the leveling of the playing field that democracy brings us. Two is science. And three is the pursuit for the lowest common denominator that is the internet. Okay, so in the UK, the National Environmental Resources Council or something like that, they have commissioned a $287 million British research ship, so a new Arctic research vessel, and they asked the internet to name it.
Okay. Uh-oh.
This is great. You know where it's going. And they had some, you know, some pretty good submissions, like the RSS David Attenborough. That's great. They had the Endeavour, the Shackleton, the Falcon, and, you know, people got to vote. So the winner thus far, and I'm not sure that Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II is going to actually follow through with the christening on this, winning by a score of more than 100,000 votes is the RRS... sorry, I can't do this. I'm going to do it. Bodie McBoatface.
Clearly, the under 5-year-old set was overly representative.
In fact, the rush to vote for votes on the website, the Name Our Ship website, was so great they shut the website down. Uh-huh. And Bodie McBoatface wasn't even the best of them. There was the RRS It's Bloody Cold Here, the RRS Usain Boat, the RRS I Like Big Boats and I Cannot Lie, the RRS What Iceberg. So, internet, we love you, even though you always manage to disappoint. That's my hubbub for today. Nancy Gertner is the retired federal judge and a current Harvard Law School professor. Judge Gertner, always great to have you.
Nice to be here again.
And Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and a research fellow at the Ash Center at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Charlie, it's great to have you. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We'll be right back.